Good morning, it's 8 a.m. You're listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. This is regional news for the Western Slope. I'm Travis Bubinick. The Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration says it's still assembling the investigation team that will look into the deaths of two miners at the Revenue Virginius mine near Ouray last week. As The Watch reports, the team will include about a dozen MSHA officials who will interview miners, mine management, and the public about the accident. The team will also be looking at the mine site itself, checking equipment and machinery for problems, and searching for any safety violations that might have been involved with the accident. MSHA currently has a notice on its website asking for anyone with information about the cause or any contributing factors to the accident to contact Mike Trombel, the team's lead investigator, and the agency says it won't be releasing any details about the investigation until after it's finished. Nick Capano of Montrose and Rick Williams of Durango were killed last Sunday after being overcome by high levels of carbon monoxide about a mile and a half inside the mine in Ouray County. Small western towns that fall victim to the boom and bust cycles of mining or oil and gas often try to reinvent themselves through tourism or other lower impact industries. But in the latest issue of High Country News, reporter Marshall Swearingen tells the story of one South Dakota mining town that's refashioned itself as a center for cutting-edge physics research. KDNK's Nelson Harvey spoke to Swearingen for the latest edition of Sounds of the High Country, and he learned that while scientific research may not pack the economic punch of the mining industry, it has all sorts of unintended educational benefits.
For more than 100 years before it closed in 2001, the Homestake Gold Mine in Lead, South Dakota had been one of the best producing gold mines in the entire country, if not the world. But even before the last bit of gold had been extracted and the mile-deep mine had been shuttered for good, it came to the attention of a group searching for an entirely different sort of jackpot beneath the surface of the earth. They were scientists. Physicists who thought they could find clues about Earth's origins in the unperturbed depths of the mine.
Basically, what these physicists are searching for are extremely small and elusive pieces of the cosmos.
High Country News reporter Marshall Swearingen.
So they hope to observe these rare processes that involve neutrinos, which are tiny particles that were discovered in the 1950s, as well as theoretical particles of dark matter, which physicists haven't observed yet. But they believe make up more than 25% of the universe.
The mine was thought to be an ideal place to find these particles because it extended so far underground and offered a shield from the tumultuous surface of the Earth.
There's still nearly a mile of solid bedrock overhead, and that bedrock blocks cosmic rays, which are basically little bits of atomic shrapnel that are hurling through the universe from black holes and supernova. So on the surface of the Earth, the cosmic rays would overwhelm these subtle signals that physicists are trying to detect. So one physicist at the lab likened the condition on the surface of the Earth to a football stadium that's roaring with the cheers and clapping of fans. And the signals that they're trying to detect are more like the breathing of a single person in the stands.
The Sanford Research Lab finally opened in 2012 after years of construction and plenty of public money from South Dakota, along with private money from the lab's namesake, a former high-interest credit card tycoon named Benny Sanford. For years, the lab's boosters had justified it in terms of the economic health it could bring to the depressed former mining town of Lead. But soon it became clear that physics research wasn't quite the cash cow that gold mining had been. True, about 70 of the lab employees had formerly worked at the Homestake mine, but the unpredictable flow of government money for research, especially research into something that no one had ever seen, tended to mute the lab's financial impact. Still, Swearingen says that the overall intelligence of the body politic in Lead did seem to benefit from the strange research taking place underground.
A lot of the initial push to create the lab was reducing the benefits kind of to dollar figures, saying that the lab would bring this number of jobs and this number of dollars to this area that had been hit by the collapse of the mine there. But what intrigued me was now that the lab has been constructed and the science is happening, the economic impacts haven't been as much as people thought they would were going to be, but people really seem just genuinely interested in the science and what's happening, and there's kind of this spirit of enthusiasm in the community for the science.
And there was a long list of educational perks associated with the Stanford Lab for kindergartners and graduate students alike.
Students from the local high school do projects at the lab. You might remember in high school doing some kind of science fair project, but you probably didn't have a chance to do a project related to cutting-edge physics that's happening a mile underground. And there are students from local community colleges that do internships at the lab. But I think the most obvious example of how the lab has affected education in the area is that it's created PhD programs at a couple of universities in the state.
Many South Dakotans think that science PhD students are good people to have around. They're smart, full of energy, and they often work in high-paying, innovative industries. In some small way, the Stanford Lab may be helping to keep more of South Dakota's young people with an interest in science from having to leave home to pursue their careers.
Listeners are probably familiar with the concept of brain drain, which is basically where young people leave rural areas for opportunities in more urbanized areas. And I think in kind of a basic sense, the lab is reversing the brain drain in this part of western South Dakota.
And although it's far from guaranteed, the importance of the work that's taking place at the Stanford Lab could extend beyond the economic impact of meals eaten or hotel rooms occupied by visiting scientists, and even beyond the benefit of educational programs that the lab inspires. What's ultimately discovered at the Stanford Lab could help us find at least one answer to the basic human question, why are we here? For KDNK News, I'm Nelson Harvey.
Nelson Harvey spoke with High Country News reporter Marshall Swearingen. State Senator Evie Hudak has resigned her seat at the state legislature, saying the move would save residents in her district along the Front Range the $200,000 it would have cost to hold a special election. Hudak has been the target of another recall effort waged against her by gun rights activists who were set to turn in petition signatures for the recall effort in just a few days. Hudak was being targeted for her support of new gun laws passed by state Democrats earlier this year. As the Denver Post reports, this wasn't the first time Hudak was threatened with a recall. An earlier attempt over the summer failed. And activists then turned their efforts to state lawmakers Angela Harone and John Morse, also supporters of the new gun regulations. Those two, however, were successfully ousted from office. According to the Post, it was unlikely Hudak would have survived a recall election, as she won re-election last year by less than 600 votes. In her resignation letter, Hudak stood strong with the new gun laws. Her decision to step down makes sense for state Democrats, as they could have lost their majority control of the Senate if she was replaced with a GOP candidate. Now, under state law, Hudak's successor will be somebody from her own party. Hudak opponents criticized the move as cowardly, saying it should have been the voters' right to decide, and Hudak supporters, meanwhile, claimed the recall effort was another distraction to the democratic process from right-wing activists. A lawsuit filed against the state and Governor John Hickenlooper over the new gun laws has been partially thrown out by a federal judge. The Post reports a U.S. district judge has ruled that the 55 sheriffs from across the state who filed the suit can't sue the state as law enforcement officers. However, that judge ruled the sheriffs could still bring the suit forward as individual citizens. The judge also said the 21 other plaintiffs in the case could carry on with the suit, which claims the new laws violate the Second Amendment. Critics have argued some of the law's language is too vague and that law enforcement and civilians would have a hard time complying with them. In his ruling, the district judge dismissed that concern, saying the explanations and guidance handed out by the Attorney General's office sufficiently explained the law's details. And the Salvation Army's Community Thanksgiving meal fed around 700 people of all ages yesterday at the Elk Lodge in Grand Junction. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports people from all walks of life came out to the annual Thanksgiving event. The Salvation Army worked with Canyon View Vineyard Church this year to also deliver meals to more than 1,200 people who couldn't leave their homes. You're listening to regional news here on KVNF. A reminder, as you're maybe beginning your holiday shopping today, that the annual KVNF holiday auction kicks off on Monday and runs through next Thursday. This year's auction is also online, where you can already sign up for pre-bidding on a wide variety of items. Visit our website at kvnf.org for more details. Stay tuned for the KVNF Sports Report from Eric Gould coming up next. For KVNF News, I'm Travis Bubinick.
Greetings! This is Eric Gould with your KVNF Regional Sports Report for Friday, November 29th. In Colorado, every high school football player and coach dreams about having one more game on Thanksgiving weekend. And that dream will come true for the Montrose Indians when they will play for the 4A state championship tomorrow. The Indians have been the number one ranked team in 4A all season and compiled a 12-1 record going into tomorrow's contest. Montrose earned its spot in the title game after last week's thrilling 39-38 double overtime victory at Pueblo South. Standout senior Angelo Youngren ran for the decisive two-point conversion on the last play of the game to defeat the Colts. Youngren totaled 184 yards, over 33 carries in the big win. Veteran Montrose coach Todd Casebeer leads his charges in the Indians' seventh overall state championship appearance, having last captured the Golden Ball in 1950. Montrose will kick off against Pine Creek tomorrow at Sports Authority Field in downtown Denver. As everyone in our listening area knows, Paonia won the 1A state championship last week in an historic 32-24 victory over Centauri at Paonia Town Park. It was Paonia's first title since 1959, and members of that championship team were on hand to watch the 2013 Eagles soar to their victory. On Tuesday, head coach Brent McCray and the Eagles football program paraded down Grand Avenue to the delight of all the locals, who came out to cheer their new state champs. It was much like a scene 54 years ago, when the victory parade stretched from Midway all the way to the high school. In 1959, the state champion Eagles were led by fullback Gary Schroeder, who carried the mail on Paonia's only touchdown in a 7-0 defeat of Windsor. Just like this year's team, the 1959 squad was built around a power running game that relied on a talented offensive line to do the dirty work, as described in a story by the local newspaper, The Paonian. The Eagles' forward wall sparkled with the play of Bob Schaefer, Johnny Morrall, Bob Holt, Harry Taylor, Ray Wardlaw, Dubby Schroeder, Cliff Davis, Bill Wining, Bob Wood, Dennis Richards, Albert Roseman, and other stalwarts. The 2013 offensive line had the likes of Drew Lee at center, Tony Darling and Josh Kimball on the right side, and Chase Park and Dylan Geisler on the left side. Also blocking on a line that amassed 320 rushing yards per game were standout tight ends Joel Siminer and Logan Schopp. McCray on Saturday called the offensive line the heart of our team. Again, in a remarkable similarity, both championship teams had possibly the best offensive backfields in the state, running behind those lines, as described by the Paonian. A deciding factor in the championship game were the outstanding efforts of one of the finest running backfields in the state, Gary Schroeder, Kinky Stratton, and Danny Cholis, capably directed by the signal calling of Bob Sunich. The 2013 Eagles offense ran a formation called Maryland, which featured four of its best players in the backfield. Quarterback Ty Coates handed the ball to running backs Will Austin and sophomore sensation Taylor Walters, who finished the season as the seventh best rusher in the entire state of Colorado, with over 1,800 rushing yards. Both Walters and Austin, who finished the season with over 1,300 rushing yards, were set free by fullback Gunnar Chesnick, who blocked and cleared running lanes like a human wrecking ball. The greatest thing about high school football is its connection to the past. The 2013 will always be linked to the 1959 team, and both groups of players now have something that can never be taken away. Finally, a last statement by the Paonian offers a perfect summary of both teams. Paonia school patrons and football fans can be well proud of the gentlemen who comprise the Paonia High School football team. Their actions brought only credit to the team and to the town which they represented. And that concludes your KVNF Regional Sports Report for Friday. Congratulations to the Eagles, the Indians, and every team in our listening area. And good luck. Stay tuned for future sports reports here at KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. This is Eric Gould. Have a great weekend, and thanks so much for listening.